interrupting the current neo-Ukrainian climate change behaviorally controlled energy-starved postulated cricketism. To bring you behind the woodshed, this is Cricketude Busting episode BTWRLM 490. The most jam-packed minute in radio for 2 hours straight, without a break, folks. Break free, behind the woodshed. And remember, being free is not a spectator sport. So get you behind the woodshed, where you start to take a bit of control. And before you get to do that, you're going to have to do a little bit of study. And I don't know what to do about more about to tell you. You have to do the study. And whether or not you have to go as deep and as long as I have, especially since I'm talking to you about it, maybe where to focus your energy is another story. But the more you learn, the more you dig, research, go back in the history, the better things start to pull together for us, for you. Whether or not that ends up being a total relief is another question. I'll talk a little bit about that today. Today's going to be a little bit different. I'm going to read some documents to you to give us a bit of a foundation, at least for you all to start, to understand a little bit how I tie stuff together, not necessarily from these sources, but these sources I'm going to read from were instructive to me as I was gaining more knowledge. In fact, some of the things that I'm going to talk to you about may have to be adjusted because they were written here about 30 years ago. I've touched that up before. But right now, we're dealing in a time of where the government, those that are behind the scenes understood, I think I started to see it here late, maybe 20 years ago, that the police power, well, it had to be a little longer than 20 years ago because I saw 9/11. I said they went and done it. They triggered this police power thing. And I told you about that long after I started broadcasting. This is the insight I want you to start having because it changes how you address things. It allowed me, my studies before all that, allowed me to see how people were getting beat up, you know, and asking the question, why are people getting beat up by the government? And despite, you know, you're supposed to have rights and things. Well, it seems seemingly, and this is where you get the possibility and probabilities of things as you read research, there's categories of potential of what's going on. And I started to analyze for those. And I started to synthesize all that down to information on, okay, these things are happening. We don't know exactly which one. I can prove quite a few pathways. How are we going to respond to it? And this becomes an ultimate problem in what we are talking about today. And then we found out that in a health emergency, no one understands how to respond. And that was a real eye-opener to me. Notwithstanding what I was saying, and notwithstanding how to tell you how to do it, and some of you stepped up. Some of you prepared yourself a bit. I'm real happy to see that for you, for us, essentially, when you get more of us together. But I wanted to touch something here. The police power is what they're moving on. And really, these are terms, not words. Understand that. We're not talking in what you think is the dictionary language. And we're not talking necessarily on what the dictionaries say, because statutory law is terms. If a legislature says that green is red, then it's red for that purpose. A lot of people have trouble with all this, but that's the way this thing is working. And when you start addressing that, you don't have to buy into it as far as I agree. What you say is that's what they do and how am I going to contend with it? It gives you that insight. If you don't come with that way, you won't have that insight. So I want to touch back because of the pervasiveness of it was occurring to me as I was thinking, what am I going to do? I'm kind of hobbled right now until we get the system back up and Vince is doing great work to maybe get us there for next week. We'll hope that works out. But my thoughts were turning, okay, where do I go with this for y'all? Some of the foundation you need to know, why I talk about what I talk about, and why I point out to certain things, and where I've talked about that, not necessarily talking in the past, but I'm going to go through some references to show you what I've been talking about is supported even in the dictionary. It's even in the construct of how things work down. And then we're going to go historic, and I'm going to show you a little bit about possibly why. You know, I think you'll be able, when you do the research, you'll know that's exactly why. If not exactly the mechanism down underneath and who the players all are, you'll understand when I'm talking to you, we live in an occupied country. You're going to find out there's a long, old institution, and I'm going to touch on that, which is relevant till today, and why we might be seeing these things for right people that believe in justice and this and that, believed in all that law that was supposed to come and the relief we were supposed to have, that it's not showing up, and it may not have been ever planned to. And it's really the occupier is a balancing act that they do. In fact, even in administrative law, they talk about the balance. They have to balance. And so moving on here to what I think is important for us this week, really what you have to hold in your mind, because you're all being suffering by it. And they triggered the problem And I told you it was medical martial law, but it's actually a form of police power by whomever is in control. And I, there's another, as I've shown you, the potential possibility that this is a military op. And you're going to find out, interestingly, it's in a different jurisdiction. When I get through this today, you're going to find out it's in a totally different jurisdiction than what we all think. And this is the part of the problem. This is not the way people, normal people don't think about this. This construct was made to work against and exploit what normal people think. And so I'm going to bring up some terms today. You really just can't jump on the bandwagon of the terms. You really have to understand these things are a lot deeper. I'll try not to interject when I get to reading, but there's going to be some things I want to clarify. These people will speak when I get to their section. They speak in glowing terms of themselves, and they're not telling the full truth. And to tell you that little things happened in history, which is why you have to go look back to see how things were adulterated, what things continued, and then ask the question, if it's not told, why would those continue? And understand what corporation does. Corporation allows a cover. Names allow a cover. Understand the P and a cup. There's no P. The cup is an exploitation game. It's like magic. And so move into today. We're under police power of sorts, and I lose some of the time here. I'm using these terms loosely, but it is a power that is resorted to, and we can see that in a definition. And I'm going to I was going to use a Black's Law edition dictionary, but I have a pocket edition, and I think it consolidates things better. If you go to the internet and find the Black's Law, I was going to read out of edition 9, but that separates. It separates it in 2 points. Police power. Let's talk about police power. Why is it relevant? Because you all been suffering under, and you had a way, and I told you how, to go back and attack even this so-called sovereign power. Remember, these are forms of government that are limited to the extent that we understand that. And there's the obligation on the limitation is essentially due process. And you're going to hear that right here. These police powers, these are not, at least in America, are not overarching powers to club everybody to death. And then I'm going to move from there into this, explaining what we're suffering relative to a so-called health emergency, and to move into a remedy, a potential remedy. It was really simple. I've talked about it, and we'll touch that, and I'll read about that. And then I'm going to go into why that relief may not be available, why we're cautioned to understand what I've been saying about learning things very well before we move into things. And it's not about, I got to learn. There's a certain level of learning. Part of that is a lot of experience of what you're testing and what you thought you learned. And that's how I've essentially refined my knowledge, if it's knowledge. Because ultimately, we really don't know the beginnings of this. We can just see there's supposed to be paperwork that you can find. Well, they keep that pretty sequestered. And so you have to do some of the study. But police power, and I will read 9 because it breaks in the 9th edition, because it breaks it up into 2 parts. And I want you to understand, number one is there to be a statement of a absolute, but the second version actually shows you the implementation. That police power is the inherent and plenary power of a sovereign to make all laws necessary and proper to preserve the public security, order, health, morality, and justice. It is the fundamental power essential to government, and it cannot be surrendered by the legislature or irrevocably transferred away from government. Case states, 21 in this reading, quote, it is possible to evolve at least 2 main attributes or characteristics which differentiate the police power. It aims directly to secure and promote the public welfare, and it does so by restraint or compulsion. It was written by Ernest Bruin, the police power, section 3 at 3, 1904. And I'm thinking I'm not going to read the citations. It takes too long, and unless you're interested, you've got to get the book. You can track it down once you see this stuff. That you can go find out the context that that was. But see, restraint and compulsion. Comply or die, right? That can be where it's at. But there's a second definition part here, and it says a state's 10th Amendment right, subject to due process and other limitations, to establish and enforce laws protecting the public's health, safety, and general welfare, or to delegate this right to local governments. Number 3 here, as they show loosely, the power of the government to intervene in the use of privately owned property, as by subjecting it to eminent domain, see eminent domain. Let me go back to that. That requires due process. That requires other limitations. And so look very carefully. Police power isn't absolute. In this case, we're dealing with this Kobe fraud thing, the potentially militarily advanced as an operation against us. But see, they did say public health. Well, the word public here is interesting. It usually means the sovereign itself, the government. But the sovereign is not so sovereign. The sovereign is not subject. The sovereign decides, period. And so this is the fact that we have this interesting statement that it's subject to due process, even so, by itself, shows that this is not a sovereignty. And plenary powers may have many powers to do something, but it's not without limit. Okay, so I wanted you to point that out, because why? We get back to the state's 10th Amendment right to do protecting public health. It's exactly what I've been telling you is the exclusive domain of the state. And so we're used a second definition here, and it shows that there's this police power, this inherent and plenary power, is subject to due process and other limitations. Okay, this is very important, because now we go to the health law, the communicable disease law, and it says there's due process that's required. And I pointed you all out to how to identify that the duty, go to the duties now, they're written right there, black and white, the duty was upon a local health official as delegated by the legislature. Construct the government in your mind. You got the legislature, the executive, and the judiciary. So the legislature made the law. The executive administers that law, implements that law. And that law, the legislature, said that the local official would deal with your health law. And the local legislature said for communicable disease, it would go thus and such. And that's what I directly pointed you to. So despite this inherent and awesome plenary power of the state in its sovereign capacity, it's no such thing. But you have to understand how to get at it. So this is very important about why I'm saying where you attack. The only thing I note at this point to attack, the lingering thing that's hanging out relative to all the stuff that we're looking at, however they derive it and however they try to destroy us in any capacity of our life, whether that's the health, using the health or our economy or your needs or whatever against you. These people are doing it, first of all. That should have been a big clue. But there's a certain process that if you keep silent on this, like as I've been saying, you got to get behind the wood. You got to bring these people to toe on the enumerated duty, the black and white duty. And you see that right in this definition. And so until you know, so the way this works, I got to remind us, the definitions in the dictionaries don't mean anything if the statutes rule. If the statutes don't rule, then the state has adopted a dictionary that it will use in interpreting the word that's not, any word that's not defined, or any word that courts have not defined. And this is where it starts this other convolution that goes on that I think people overlook. And it's mind-numbing. I agree. But we're in a prison, and unless you kind of acknowledge that, unless you acknowledge it, you're in a lockdown condition of some sort. You always have been. They just made it obvious in this health fraud. They triggered that. They did it in 9/11. They triggered all that. And I wondered at Operation Hindsight 2019, December 31st, would the people of society recognize that? Well, we saw they didn't. Absolutely didn't. Notwithstanding, there was a voice, at least one voice, that was explaining from before it started how to get yourself on the right side of history, if you will, even against the oppressor, even against these people that triggered that. At least you cause neutrality. And I guess that the best I can do here is not give you a silver bullet. I can give you at least a time and a space to respond to these people that brings a neutrality. I don't know that we're going to be getting justice. And so we have in that definition before that they're supposed to bring justice. There is no justice they're bringing. These occupiers are in violation right up front. Okay, enough there. We can go on and on. I can talk about this really over and over, about how we get at it. The point is, what do you start to do about it? And this is what I was telling you before. Go find the black and white that's already there and just use it, because you don't have another power. You have no. When they say there's the inherent power in plenary, you have no power. You have to go after their duties and obligations within what's handed to them. And I'm going to say Black's Dictionary is not my favorite dictionary. It's another one of a lot of them, I think, now anymore. They adjust them as the years go by and the case law gets adjusted. As common law, the judge-made law gets adjusted to give the occupier more protection, so do the definitions. That's why it's important to look over a broad spectrum and then apply to history what they're talking about. We're going to talk about a word, the civil law. That's got a very special meaning in international law. That comes out of Benedict of Anvilton. If you don't know what civil law is and it's not your local go down and sue someone for a contract breach, you don't understand that, you don't know the jurisdiction you're in. Okay, so a little bit of pause here. There's a lot to think about when we go through this. And so today is going to be me reading at some point here, and boy, put on your thinking caps. And I want you to start applying it not just to the government that they're applying and not just to the attorneys that we're going to speak about, but apply it to the private people who come under that. You'll hear every once and again, you'll hear a reference that anybody who causes a complaint, it's anybody, not just the government, but some, even a private citizen. Now I want our private business or anybody private. That's where I want to attach to your idea, this police power that third parties wield that have no authority. And what that then means in a potential remedy, which I got kind of interested in here in the last week when I re-found it. And I started to think, again, you re-study and then you rethink and then you reapply because you have things you can apply it to. The terms and the words and all this start to make better sense. So let's go back one more time for the police power. It's the state's ability under 10th Amendment, constitutional, so such that it is, to delegate to a local authority a certain thing. And then we see, so inside the health, we go to health officer, and that's defined as a government official charged with executing and enforcing the health laws. Charged is like energy. Charged, remember discharge, dishonor, discharge, that kind of stuff. Get rid of the charge. Yeah, all that stuff kind of works here as another guidance on how this thing can be adjusted. The government health officer is a government official charged with executing and enforcing health laws. The powers of the health officer, such as the Surgeon General, are regulated by law. Well, let's go look at the definition. Executing and enforcing health laws is that whoever the official is to enforce the health laws that are written by the legislature. What did I want to attack right up front? Was that the duty of the charged with the enforcing the health laws did not and cause you irreparable harm. So when they fail, when the local official as delegated by the law, by the legislature of the state, as delegated to it by the 10th Amendment of the Constitution, completely creating a chasm to the federal government, cannot touch, that district over there cannot touch. We now have the failure of the health official to execute and enforce. So we have this thing about faithfully executing. And so when you send your notice in, you are saying, wait, I see the duty, but I don't see it fulfilled. And that's your duty, and you can't be moving beyond that. And so we see in this police power definition, the health official delegated by the legislature for the 10th Amendment power to do so failed to execute and faithfully so and enforce the health law. No, they did it wantonly and willfully in disregard of that. And that causes a very interesting thing, which kind of evolved into my thoughts. Again, this is a very real war, whether people want to see it. It's not something I shrug my shoulders at. I haven't for quite a few decades now that I've been identifying it. But remember, we talked about one gentleman, I think his name was John J. Singleton. He was offering what you do when you got involved with a private party that was going to stop you from walking into a store for some health thing. Or in this case, think about it, general, expand this a little bit. For anything you had a right to do, and even if it's a private government, a private business that holds itself open to the public, you have the same right as everyone else to enter that store for the purpose of that business. They've done that. When they obstruct your right and you aren't doing anything unlawful, then they have done something which we found out. If I went, as I said, go through John J. Singleton's idea, it's the same thing as I say you become an investigative reporter. He said you make an incident report. Then you contact the facilities manager. Remember? And what are you doing? You're setting up what? You're setting up the facts, and the facilities manager should be an attorney. You're setting up the facts of the what? The obstruction of your right to enter and the trespass upon you. And so where I'm going to go here to the next thing is, what's the relief? It's not just a trespass. What it is, it's like an, and I'll read now from a document here soon. It's a breach of an old principle. It becomes a form of battery, an assault. It's not just a trespass. It's a false imprisonment. And this is what I wanted to move on to here. We've got these powers, and when the duty is not met, then whoever keeps you from doing what your life was normally doing causes in you a false imprisonment. And again, this is not a silver bullet. this has to be really thought through. And the document I'm going to read to you was written back in the 90s. A lot of case law may have come through that adjusted this. A lot of thought about the system looking at how they protect their criminal agents to keep beating on you comes into play. I have direct experience that happens, that you're going to have to qualify. So none of this thing I'm going to read to you is a silver bullet. It's a starting point. You're going to qualify the things that you might hear that sound important, and more will be important as you read it. Well, I'm going to read it here, that you will move like John J. Singleton do. He said, well, you get to the trespass. That was a trespass. I'm going to move it one step further. Say, what we were really talking about appears to be a false imprisonment, even though you're not in jail. And this is the very fascinating things about that. And let me offer you another inducement to think about it. It only has two elements. One is the whoever the party was that stopped you, and what they stopped you in. That's it. And the burden shifts. And I've told you, watch for these burden-shifting actions. You don't have the burden to explain. Now, I'm going to go through a lot of this. You don't have a lot to explain what everybody else thinks you have to explain. And I'm not saying that I got a refresher on a lot of this as well. Especially, I can't remember now which point. There was one point I said, oh, that's right, that would be there. This fact, in fact, doesn't require that we do these statements. But we do have certain things. I said, speak through that. That's what I've been talking to you about. John J. Singleton was telling us, make that incident report. I've said, become an investigative reporter. What are you doing? You're getting all the elements of the harm against you. And so I want to move on now to a document that I've had, and I don't know if it's available. Again, you might find some of this stuff on the internet. The last book I'm going to hopefully get to here is, it should be on the internet. It was a Google Preservation Project document. But before we get there, I want to advance this idea of false imprisonment just merely in some regard here, just merely for stopping you from doing what you have right to do, your right of locomotion, your right of your intention. You're free to do that. Someone holds themselves out like a third party. So I'm actually focusing on the third party here. They're going to talk when I start writing in government and the police and all that. Extend your thought out to third parties that are doing the same thing to you underneath the color of official emergencies, a color of official considerations. In some regards, it just occurred to me. They have, like, for fire, right now we're in fire season, they have levels, different levels, and I found out a long time ago, they can order you out of the forest, they can order you from not going in, but they can't keep you out. And if you know the words about how to bring yourself back in, despite the danger, they can't actually mandatorily do anything. Now, I'm not saying for you all to do that in a fire area. Stay away from the fire area. But some of us, like Mineral State grantees, who have our machinery and our claims in the forest, and we have to do certain protective mechanisms, or we have to protect while the fire is purportedly being fought. Typically, they're being managed to burn you out. That someone's not stealing our stuff. So we've had to go in. Anybody who's seen my petition for redress, you see the fire that they firebombed us, and you see the pictures of our guys trying to get themselves out. So this is serious business. But we have the right to go in, and there's no law that can stop us, and the sheriff found that out pretty quickly. So all this power, if you understand the due process problem and the rights that are pertinent to whatever the government has granted you, are the things that you stick to. In that regard, you're also going to be backing up into a thing that the government granted that it needs. And that's a different angle. And this now brings up the international aspect that I keep talking to you about, that I also bring in. But right, now moving into, John J. Singleton said, you make your incident report, you get all the facts that you need to do. I talked about it. I said, follow his. If you can't understand me, follow his methodology. It's pretty straightforward. I said, just attach the law to that. Make sure that you don't negate that the duties haven't been formed. And I also told you how to handle the direct statement that they have to prove that you are going to cause death by coming into the store if it was a healthcare emergency. I told you, I did a whole broadcast on how the state handled that. So you have to bring these couple of elements in when you do that incident report. But what we were talking there was the trespass upon you. You're not trespassing the government. You're not trespassing the business. You're not trespassing against the things that other people have the right to do. What you're doing is they're trespassing you. And this goes on higher. It's not just trespassing you. Now, it moves into a false imprisonment. Now, you have to understand what's going on here. You're not in jail. You're standing right there being impeded from what you have right to do that everyone else has a right to do, and the fact there's no unlawfulness of what you're doing. Just standing there and being impeded is considered a false imprisonment. Now, not just, you don't, okay, so for all you guys that are auditors and gals that are auditors, don't just start hounding on this. This is not something you say, oh, this is false imprisonment. No, you have to let them violate you. So you're just going to take reports on how they're violating, and you're going to get them later. So don't think this is a silver bullet. You get to yell in some cop's face about all the rights you're being violated and all how trouble they're going to be. That's not what I'm talking about doing. We're talking about coming into a position where you get stopped in your right to do certain things. You better have that totally online. You better have it completely available in how this works, not to tell them, but more than to say the basic obstruction to set the note, but you're going to have to come later to say you were falsely imprisoned by the right track. You don't want to make a big deal about this, actually. You just want to get the record of how they did it to you. And it's kind of interesting how simple it is. But, caveat, and why I'm saying this is not a silver bullet, again, this is the stuff I almost dread talking about. It's that gun that seems like I'm handing to a young baby that pulls the trigger and kills the cat kind of stuff, or even hurts themselves or their mother or father. This is dangerous stuff to let the government, who has that awesome power, in on you when you do it wrong. Not a fear thing. It's understanding. And so to this point, that you may have everything right and still not see justice, I want to read the end of a document that was written by Charles Weissman way back when, in 93 to 96, I think he's copyrighted it. It's called The Treatise on Arrest and False Imprisonment. So another caveat. It may or may not be. It may be as he felt it. It may be what he found. The case law may be the case law. It may not be applicable to your condition. You really have to think about this stuff. A lot of people may just say it's too hard, but this is where they have us. And you're going to see him in this statement, the very end statement. He says that. He says that this was done because we weren't vigilant. But more importantly, he walked in with all the knowledge I'm going to read, the excerpts I'm going to read from this document. He walked in with all this knowledge, and this is what happens to him. When I went to court, George Weissman, a while back, the name sounds familiar to me. I don't know if I ever knew about him or knew him. Something's familiar about him, but anyway, I don't underwrite everything that's here. There's some problems with what he was writing in my understanding of things. So, but they're a good general review for this false imprisonment. Fascinating. Very, in a way, it's a bit empowering, but you have to go through the understanding of it and then apply it correctly. But, he writes near the very end of his document. When I went to court for a motion hearing, I was assigned to a judge whom I knew was fairly good and honest. But after sitting in the courtroom for about an hour, my name was not called. Unknown to me at the time, the county attorney, parenthetically, who had the disposition of a weasel, had my file removed from the stack on the judge's desk and reassigned the case to another judge. After a while, a clerk came into the courtroom and said my case had been moved to another courtroom. I went to that room and sat there for about 12 minutes. Then two attorneys came out of the judge's chamber, followed by the judge. They had been plotting and conspiring against me and convincing the judge to dismiss my case. This was because they came to realize that the law was not on their side, and even the statutes prohibited the officers from doing what they did. The system would be in jeopardy if this case went to trial. This is George Weissman's opinion, but I can tell you I've experienced this. And justice may not be what you get. Relief may not be what you get. What you might get is whatever they agree to. And this is where you see these, you might call them lawyers. They're attorneys. They're attorneys. Charles Weissman says they're attorneys. And we're going to find out how that works. We're going to find out where these people have placed themselves in history and how they're here today, these attorneys. So, he walks in with all this knowledge I'm going to read to you. And he still doesn't get the relief he's supposed to get. They ended up paying his legal fees, attorney, which means he had an attorney. And so, there's a whole lot of problems with this, generally. And not that if you don't have an attorney, you win, but they won't do that to you. No, this is very serious analysis that has to be done to figure out how does this battlefield lay out and what are the games that they play to mitigate the damage to the occupier, which oppresses you. He goes on to write near the end and through the end. Problems such as these exist. This fact that they're not supposed to do that, but they got together. They're making a deal without your involvement, without your consent, without your rights, without the right to relief. And they make this decision, and they ameliorate the problem. And he goes, problems such as these exist today because the maxim, quote, eternal vigilance is the price of liberty, was not followed. Our continual suffering from the acts of corruption and oppression in the land is the price we now have to pay for the failure of past generations to guard the law and their liberty when threatened by acts of government. Yet the truth is that no one can protect a right he does not know exists. With this material, it is intended to inform many of the true law so as to guard their liberty for themselves and for future generations. Those who work for a corrupt government do all sorts of unlawful acts to protect the, quote, system, those, quote, which feeds them. They must resort to lies, cover-ups, or distortions of the law. But there is one thing that they can never do, and that is to give a just and lawful reason for their answer, for their actions. Read that again. But there is one thing they can never do, and that is give a just and lawful reason for their actions. That's one of the keys. When he wrote that, that's exactly what you're looking for. You're going to find out the decisions have no reasons behind them. And when you go to equity, you're going to find out that's required. There's a foundation for a decision to has to be made. And when you find none, you realize you're dealing with this corruption, this oppression. And so part of the answer, part of the problem is looking forward. How are you going to defeat that? How are you going to go? How are you going to work to stop or to out? If again the exposure of how the system did that. How many times I've seen court cases that's happened to me. I think I've explained it without getting too more deep. I went to the Supreme Court of the state court and argued that they were blocking, obstructing justice by not allowing me into the court. After 9 months, they came back. And in the meantime, I required a move to have all the rules that didn't prejudice either any party or the court to be suspended. Because you can do that, because they were a burden now to do all that to get to the point of whether or not I should have access to a court of law. And they waited 8 or 9 months before they said, well, your motion to suspend the rules is granted, but we're going to deny you. And there was no reason. And so when I look back, I'm like, okay, why is there no reason? Well, that's a violation in the equity side. And really, your courts are, if you understand civil, your courts are sitting in an equity condition, but in a different jurisdiction. And there, again, has to be this foundation. Reason and logic has to come to play. Morals have to come to play. It's equity. And so, yes, that's necessary, not necessarily so objective. At least goes back to some authority. And so they didn't give me an authority. They just denied my access to the court. And I figured out a way how to sue federal officials in a state court, and I'm sure that was played heavily when you understand that the state governments are getting lots of funds from the federal government. I don't even know if we have state courts anymore. But moving in now to discuss this with the caveats, because you know this stuff doesn't mean that it's actual for you, that you're going to have to do a little bit more. I do want to expose you to this, because this is very fascinating to me, how simple this little remedy seems to be, which we've talked about. I've set you up for it. And those of you who may find yourself the ability to frame your harm, your obstruction in such a way and understand how this works may have a very quick relief, a remedy to this, even if it's just to test the courts, test the thing, get into exercising a problem. I don't know how, if you have your rights, if you are falsely imprisoned, how it can be viewed that you would be in trouble for filing the suit, even if it doesn't go your way. That would be your impression if your facts are there. And then you could do some other analysis. But this was a treatise on arrest and false imprisonment by Charles Wiseman, and this was last published that I have a copy of the document. I don't know if you can find this on the internet or not. It's 1996. So I'm going to go through some excerpts, and it's going to be quite a read, but I want you to listen. Hopefully you'll stick with me. You'll listen. And listen and expand what I'm saying to third parties. Think about the, as you can, Think about what's being said. There's no absolutes here. I guess another caveat. I don't agree with common law. Most people don't understand common law is judge-made law. It's not what you think. We all want to put this romantic thing on it that it was in the past and it carried on. Yeah, there were some customs. There were some traditions. There were some things like that. But the common law that they're talking about that seems to filter through was judge-made law. It's these attorneys that turn into decision-makers. And they have an origin. And they have an international origin. And they have a jurisdiction. And so, these possibilities, potentials, probabilities sit there for us to analyze. We can choose to ignore them, potentially at our peril, if they're working in the world. And I believe they are. That's why I'm talking about it. However, when you understand that, there is I tell you about the narrow path. There's a narrow path to follow. And I've found it, if you don't get the relief or remedy, you at least neutralize the harm that they're doing to you. Now, some people have lived under the right stars and they tend to work out real well. I've never been that guy. I tend to find the hardest things to have to do and the most arduous paths to take to find out to get to maybe neutral or nothing. As I say, just another thing. Ever since I now do collateral attacks on things of administrative functions, for sure, and if I have a property right underneath that, even judicial considerations, every time I collaterally attack those in the government that try to charge, and this is done by quite a few people that I've helped, we collaterally attack those charges, those things disappear. We don't get the relief and we don't get the justice, but the attack is stopped. The affront, the plunder is stopped. So there's a shift that's happened in what I've seen. Again, the people that I know that are minors don't go to federal court. A lot of minors who don't listen went to federal court for a long time. They don't understand how to deal with this and what to assert. Getting back to or in the proper jurisdiction, in this case, would be equity. Continually talk more about equity because that seems to be the only thing that's filtering through in a way. And then with the underlying jurisdiction that's international that I've already talked to you about, I don't want to make a big flag about it because people don't understand when we'll get to it, but when I talk about it, it means that you shouldn't complain about it. You shouldn't complain about, oh, there's a gold fringe on a flag. You should understand the jurisdiction you're in and respond to that jurisdiction. Just understand where you are and respond as you would in that jurisdiction. Well, because you are in that jurisdiction. You only bring the relief and remedies that you need, and most of those are pretty simple. When you find out you're looking to avoid the jurisdiction and or become an ally to that jurisdiction. Oh, horrors. I'm going to be government. The king and I are one. Yeah. Under international law, that's it's called a neutral. It's a pretty cool place to be if you can establish it. If you're not going to get anything else, you better become neutral to it, right? Don't be charged so they can discharge you and process you through before. Let me start reading here. History teaches that the deprivation of liberty is more often arbitrary and unlawful than it is otherwise. At least this is always the tendency of those who hold executive power. Daniel Webster once stated this problem in these words, quote, "The contest for ages has been to rescue liberty from the grasp of the executive power," close quote. Liberty is taken away or deprived most commonly by arrest and imprisonment. The practice of easy arrests and secret imprisonments have always been an earmark of the despotic executive power. Again, under excerpts, I'm jumping through to read what I think is important to read. There may be other things here. If you find the document, it may be a publication somewhere. Then you can read more fully into this, again, with my caveats to tell you. Some of this may have changed. Some of this is applicable. You got to understand who wrote what they wrote and why they might have wrote it. And there's a whole lot more involved, but it gives you an insight. It gives you a thought that possibly, set up, understood correctly, is a very simple thing that happens to all of us. When we are, I say, in the generic public sense, typically with government or dealing with people like businesses that are relying on government laws or whatever, but they do something to us very seemingly innocent and seemingly of no consequence that are actually considered false imprisonment. I don't need the bars. I don't mean the drinking bars. I mean, I don't have the manacles. I don't have the cage. I don't have the officialdom underneath this condition to see. It happens as soon as it happens. It happens when you have a right to be doing something and they hold you back. It's kind of like a, if you will, abduction. And so read, listen for this and expand it out a little bit more than he's writing here to the government. Moving over to the history of our history here, the history of our ancestors over the centuries teaches that a people cannot be free where the executive power can arbitrarily arrest or imprison citizens or ransack at will the properties of the people. The executive power is limited and guided by the law of the land or due process of law. If it was a restriction upon the King of England, it must be so for every petty officer today. And boy, these ifs are really serious. If it was, yeah, what if it wasn't? Yeah, you got to consider these two as I'm talking about a ton of stuff here already. I've already mentioned things here. I'm looking up and I'm shaking my head again. There is so much history we don't understand that play right into these first few paragraphs that George Wiseman wrote that would condition, this would answer this if in a way, or it conditions what he's already saying. Again, don't take this to the bank. Don't take this to the claim. Just use it as a guidance. Use it as some of the facts that are there. Go research that they do exist. I'm reading it because some of this stuff does exist. This condition does exist. It's whether or not you're going to walk into it, be able to frame your situation in the context it needs to be in the state you are, or the status you may have found yourself, or maybe the fraud of the status. So moving on here again, I'm interjecting a little bit more. I'm going to try and read through. So we have due process of law, the law of the land, and due process of law. Due process of law, I kind of want to focus on because the law of the land is really kind of bizarre in a way. We all think we know what it is, but I'm not so sure that we do. Some of us have done some deep studies and found different truths. In many of the treaties on law pertaining to the rights of citizens and in many of the older and better court cases, we find the declarations, quote, the law is very jealous of the liberty of the citizen, close quote. I would hold that idea out as I'm talking about false imprisonment, and in an instant it happens when you're obstructed. You qualify that the law is very jealous of the liberty of the citizen. In other words, there hasn't been any erosion of that since 1996. Once you find that, now you start to apply the very basic, the hard principles that he's going to speak or write about here. If you don't find that, then you're dealing in a whole different condition and be very careful. And it may be possible. I've seen some instances. Well, we kind of saw it with the health emergency that wasn't. They just bought into a fraud. These people that are the attorneys turned judges are in the fraud, and they're probably knowing about it. That's why they're not giving any reasons behind what's going on, and no attorney has ever brought the right discussion, as I've explained to you, and as the definitions say, where's the due process that was executed by the health official? And this is just in the health. They do this, all of this, all these things they put onto you, these malum prohibitor or something, administrative type stuff, none of it seems to follow due process. They've been learning how to do this for a long time, and everybody, all the citizens so-called, have said, okay, that's fine. But here we are, to a problem. Now, if we stop and we set it up proper, the momentum is against false imprisonment, but you can still bring it into, for you, the proper framing to possibly bring this into a very simple action, it seems to me, which is what kind of got me focused on it. It is that very simple. The law is very jealous of the liberty of the citizen. If that's true, then we're going to go someplace here with this. What is the law that regards liberty? It is the common law, and he's got these capitalized. And it declares that one who interferes with anyone's liberty does so at his peril. One who interferes with another's liberty does so at his peril. It also prescribes how arrests are to be made. Definition of false imprisonment. What constitutes false imprisonment? False imprisonment consists of any type of unlawful restraint or interference with the personal liberty of an individual. It basically involves any unlawful violation of the liberty of another. The ancient English legal scholar Henry de Bracton, 1200 to 1268, listen to the timing when I get to the next document, I hope here, tells us that false imprisonment is one of the oldest violations of rights known. Forcefully to deprive a man of freedom to go wherever so he may is clearly a trespass. False imprisonment was indeed one of the first trespasses recognized by the common law. Capital C, capital L. It's a thing. It's not just some anything. So you got to go find out what that one is. Now I want to bring out, it's the first trespass recognized by common law. John J. Single to submit your incident report about the trespass. But it offers the remedy. When that happens, it actually offers an action for false imprisonment. And we have a potential to go against and stop people from running us down where they might. False imprisonment is classified as a tort under the common law and also as a crime. Another interjection, boy, I'm not going to do this really quick, am I? Common law is supposed to be regarded in your states, but common law can be adjusted by statute. So you got to understand how they did it and whether or not they actually adjusted what the so-called common law. This common law is lowercase now, the common law of the state that you're in or the condition that you're in. But in this case, it's a tort. You have to understand that because now you're in a particular tort. All right? So all these words are important. And I don't want to belabor all this, but again, when you're reading this, this is not just, you're just not whistling, you know, just whistling in the park here. You really have to think about it. It does take quite a study. It takes quite a concentration and a persistence. I don't know what else to do about that, folks. It's why, again, what Wiseman found, we're not vigilant to assert our rights, even know what they are, or that they even are there. And I'm saying, well, what if they're not there? They sound like they're there, but they're not there. You have to be able to analyze for that and how to extract that thing. Getting back to this, as a tort, it's also a crime. It has been labeled as a tort, a trespass, an assault, a wrong, a damage, and an injury. There we go. For me, that's more the equity. Injury, giving one cause to bring suit against another for a remedy. Depriving a person of their liberty is legally no different than depriving a person of their property. These are very powerful statements when you understand what we're talking about here. It's how I get so property. Your rights is coercion. Your property intervention without a warrant, without title, that's extortion. That's what we're talking about here. That's why it's such a high crime. Immediate, and it's an immediate thing. A theft of liberty is a wrong by which remedy can be had, just as is the case with a theft of property. I'm reading these things, and I'm saying, this is what I've been telling you all for all this time when I go to extortion, coercion, conversion. The felonies that people will do against us, that I'm astonished we have not stepped up as a people on our own to say, I'm not going to allow that abuse against me anymore. That crime, that wrong is going to stop. And so this is what my frustration of it is, that I want people to hear. It is here. We may not have direct access quite yet, but we have, again, enough people pushing that wall down, that obstruction. We change it. We change this. And that's there's a suggestion that that's why it hasn't changed. We're not changing it back to what we ought to think, what we thought common law was. Pull it out of the international sphere of control and influence. Moving into the document here, false imprisonment is a great offense due to the high regard the law has for liberty. As written in Chitty's Practice of Law, it states, the infraction of personal liberty has ever been regarded as one of the greatest injuries. The injuries to liberty are principally termed false imprisonment or malicious prosecutions. Now, I'm going to anticipate that here a bit. We're going to talk about that and how not to make the mistake that it's not make the distinction between a malicious prosecution and a false imprisonment. Essentially, we're not talking about the malicious prosecution today. This is simply being stopped when you have the right to go. One who does so doesn't have the right. It's a trespass upon you. More importantly, it's false imprisonment. Right there, while you stand there. It's really fascinating. Unlawful detention or deprivation of liberty is the basis of an action for the tort of false imprisonment. That's it. That's what you put on your paper. Actual seizure of the laying on of the hands is not necessary to constitute an unlawful detention. Thus, only essential elements of the action are one. I hope you're taking notes here, folks. This is the notes you need to have. One, the detention or restraint was against one's will. And two, the unlawfulness of such detention or restraint is the two statements you make. And then who done it? I've interjected. Let me go read that through without the interjection. Thus, the only essential elements of the actions are one, detention or restraint against one's will, and two, the unlawfulness of such detention or restraint. In his treatise of the law of torts, Judge Cooley states, false imprisonment is a wrong akin to wrongs of assault and battery and consists of imposing by force or threat an unlawful restraint upon man's freedom of locomotion. And there's footnotes attached. I'm not going to read them. If you find the document, you'll be able to see it yourself. I'm doing really an overview on this thing as well. Blackstone, in his commentaries on the law, states on this matter, every confinement of a person is an imprisonment, whether it be in a common prison or in a private house or in the stocks or even by forcibly detaining one in the public streets. Thus, any type of detainment or confinement of a person or a restriction or deprivation of their liberty or freedom of locomotion where he is compelled to remain where he does not wish to remain or to go where he does not wish to go is an imprisonment. The only question thereafter is whether or not the imprisonment is false. The word false comes from the common law and is synonymous with unlawful. A false arrest is one means of committing a false imprisonment. So understand the distinction we shifted. A false arrest is one means of committing a false imprisonment. You're going to hear they can make a rightful arrest, but the imprisonment may have been wrong. And that's all going to be on whether due process allowed the holding of you beyond what they did. Now you're going to hear some pretty fascinating things if I get through here to show you that all the processing that they've done, short of bringing you to a magistrate, it constitutes a false imprisonment, even if their arrest is proper. In describing false imprisonment as being the unlawful restraint of liberty on the citizen or on the primary right of the freedom of the locomotion, the Supreme Court of Idaho also stated, imprisonment is any restraint of a personal liberty of another and prevention of his movements from place to place or his free action according to his own pleasure and will. It is false imprisonment when this is done without lawful authority. In reviewing the several textbook definitions on false imprisonment, the Supreme Court of North Carolina stated, false imprisonment is the unlawful total restraint of the liberty of the person. The imprisonment is false in the sense of being unlawful, the right violated by his tort. This tort is freedom of locomotion. The right violated by this tort is freedom of locomotion. It belongs historically to the class of rights known as simple or primary rights. The theory of law is that one interferes with the freedom of locomotion of another at his own peril. A rather complete description of what does and does not constitute imprisonment was given by the Supreme Court of Kansas, as Toto describes as follows. False imprisonment is necessary and wrongful interference with the personal liberty of an individual. The wrong may be committed by words alone or by acts alone or by both, and by merely operating on the will of the individual or by personal violence or by both. It is not necessary that the individual be confined within a prison or within walls or that he be assaulted or even touched. It's not necessary that there should be any injury done to the individual's person or to his character or reputation, nor is it necessary that the wrongful act be committed with malice or ill will or even with the slightest wrongful intention, nor is it necessary that the act be under color of a legal or judicial proceeding. All that is necessary is that the individual is restrained of his liberty without any sufficient legal cause, therefore, and by words or acts which he fears to disregard. False imprisonment exists not only by the words or acts that one fears to disregard, but also by such acts and measures that he cannot disregard. No fear of disobedience need be exist if someone causes a situation that makes it impossible for another to exercise their liberty or locomotion. It is a false imprisonment. Interjection here. Think about what they're doing when they stop you from walking into a store, making you wear a mask. Don't need to do all that stuff. That just applied to the health emergency. There's all kinds of situations that some color of authority steps in your face. It's considered false imprisonment. And there's no necessity to identify all these other things that you normally have to in order to find a wrong in some other action. Returning to the document here, false imprisonment is the name of the category for those torts that unlawfully deprive or interfere the liberty of a person. Under this category, the unlawful arrest is the most common type of wrong committed. Another common way in which a wrong of this nature occurs is by the unlawful detention of a person in a room, jail, or other location. Definitions of false imprisonment usually come from unlawful restraints of this nature. False imprisonment has been well defined to be a trespass committed by one man against the person of another by unlawfully arresting him and detaining him without any legal authority. The law is set as such a high value upon the liberty of a citizen that even an attempt to unlawfully arrest is esteemed a great provocation. All the authorities agree that the arrest may be made either with or without any physical force or actual touching by the officer. Thus, an illegal restraint of one's personal liberty by the act of another gives the person a cause of action for false imprisonment against the one causing the illegal restraint, prima facie, any restraint put by fear or force is unlawful. False imprisonment is necessarily a wrongful interference with the personal liberty of an individual, usually made by an arrest. A physical custody or restraint is not essential to the effectuation of an arrest. So if an officer tells a person that he is under arrest, and he thereupon submits himself to the officer, going with him and obeying his orders, such person is deprived of his liberty, and if the act of the officer is unlawful, it is false imprisonment. In all cases in which there is no physical touching or seizure, nor any resistance, the intention of the parties to the transaction is considered. That's what I'm going to highlight here for the auditors. You can go with them, you let them commit the crime, you make sure that they don't have a right, you don't argue with them, you've caused the cause of false imprisonment. You actually don't have to go anywhere. But if they do arrest you, if they detain you wrongly, and you're not going anywhere you want to stick in their face, and you want to be somewhere else, you can frame your discussion to say otherwise. Let me also touch, as I'm reading, I see the word person or of another's person's talked about, or citizen. Those of you that are all uptight about those words, person and citizen, stop doing that to yourself. Calm down. These are in neutral words for us to discuss. They're only not talking about men here either. Women can have this these causes as well. So let's neutralize our condition and our perception. Don't be arguing with the words that we're here. Just listen to what they say. The word person is a neutral word, and it's supposed to be relative to someone in the capacity of the subject matter. Otherwise, what word do you use? And we did see a problem when they suggested man would be the only thing, then all of a sudden then women got rights, and women were subject. Whole other subject matter. But going on here, moving on through this, in such a case, there must have been an intent on the part of one of them to arrest or restrain another, an intent on the part of such other to submit under the belief and impression that submission was necessary. I need to interject quickly. This is we talk about getting stopped at a place because you don't have this or that or the other because of a health emergency. That's their intent. That's how you frame what you document when you're making your incident report or your journalistic report in order to make the lawsuit from and the action. You have to develop these things. There's no necessity to the other things, but you have to develop this relative to a stop, as they're talking, that doesn't constitute an official action. And it's only based on the transaction. So going on here, the following definition will provide further insight into the nature and elements of false imprisonment. False imprisonment is the unlawful restraint by one person of the physical liberty of another. And as here used, the word false seems to be synonymous with unlawful. Any exercise of force or expressed or implied threat of force by which, in fact, the other person is deprived his liberty, compelled to remain where he does not wish to remain or go where he does not wish to go, is an imprisonment. False imprisonment is the unlawful arrest or detention of a person without warrant or by an illegal warrant or a warrant illegally executed. Any restraint, however slight, upon another's liberty to come and go as he pleases constitutes an arrest. Length of time requirement. The tort or wrong of false imprisonment occurs the instant that one is restrained in the exercise of their liberty. There is no unreasonable length of time for a restraint before the tort has been claimed. False imprisonment at common law and elsewhere consists in the unlawful detention of the person of another for any length of time whereby he is deprived of his personal liberty. Where two people are traveling in a car and stopped by the police, and a party not driving is put in the police car and told to wait, the officer doing so is guilty of false imprisonment. Even though the person was in the police car for less than a minute, it was an arrest, as the police had no authority for confirming him in the car. Even where police officers stop a moving car for a brief detention, it is sufficient to constitute an arrest where one is told to stay in the car by an officer, although it be for only 10 seconds, it is an arrest. The time duration is not a factor in making an arrest. Let me interject. Other things might be very careful that you just don't, again, use this and think you have a license to go after the cop. There's been some adjustments that have been done here, though generally, you frame it in the right fact, then you do have this claim. No silver bullets here. The interjection here on this own article is that a false imprisonment is defined as an act which directly or indirectly is a legal cause of confinement of another within boundaries fixed by the actor for any time, no matter how short the duration makes the actor liable to the other. I need to interject again. Is indirectly. So this the local health official that failed the duty that the business is relying on to get in your face and detain you from enjoying where your intention was to go do business with them, that's the indirect one that you can state and insert to, again, bring another point here together on cause of unlawful imprisonment. Moving into the article again, when one is approached by an officer and the question about his identity and actions, this is only an accosting, not an arrest. And that's where we get into interjection. That's where we get into the administrative type thing. So you got to be careful on where you drop in and when you're going to assert this. Again, no silver bullet. I just got to caveat that big time. This is not something to say, oh, we're going to do, everyone's going to go run and do this. You really have to set your case up. For as simple as this one is, for as simple as the allegations are on it, they have to be correct. Everything has to be done right. Moving in back to the article, it says damages and liability. One who interferes with another's liberty of locomotion does so at his own peril. All who do so without lawful authority can be sued for the trespass upon the liberty and the loss of time. It thus is a very serious thing to deprive a person of their liberty. Since false imprisonment is a wrong suffered by a person, that person is entitled to receive a remedy for damages. Not only is a person entitled to receive a remedy for deprivation of his liberty, but also for any other damages that are a result of that deprivation. The false imprisonment was an indictable offense at common law, and relief by the party aggrieved was obtained by an action for trespass, viet armis, with force and arms. The illegal arrest of a person without a warrant and under an invalid warrant entitles him to compensation for the damages sustained by reason of the false and unlawful imprisonment. The general rule of damages in cases of false imprisonment is that the person causing a wrongful imprisonment is liable for all the natural and probable consequences thereof. The plaintiff is entitled to recover damages from what the party wrongfully did. In an action for trespass, assault, and battery, and false imprisonment, the court held that the plaintiff could recover not merely the time the constable was bringing him to jail, but for the whole period of his imprisonment. And in Mandeville versus Guernsey, the court said, quote, the arrest being wrongful, the defendant is liable for all the injurious consequences of the plaintiff which result directly from the wrongful act. Unlawful interference with or injuries to the liberty of a citizen is a violation of his natural, inherent, and absolute rights, which damage results as a legal consequence. A false imprisonment generally includes an assault and a battery, and always at least a technical assault. An unlawful arrest, imprisonment, or prosecution of a person can cause that person many damages, including bodily pain, great physical inconvenience and discomfort, loss of time, mental suffering, injury to reputation, distress or anguish, humiliation of mind, shame, public ridicule, invidious publicity, and public disgrace. Some of these damages overlap to some degree, but all can have been claimed in a false imprisonment lawsuit. I'm going to interject again. You need to support that as well, all these as well that you will find for yourself might be available. Going on and reading upon the subject of damage, the law specifies two kinds of damages or divides them into two classes. There are what are called actual damages, then there are what are called punitive damages. Actual damages are such compensation for the injury as which would follow from the nature of the character of the act. They are the damages for wrongs received and injuries done when none were intended. In a false imprisonment, they could include the pain and suffering which the average citizen would be supposed to suffer under such circumstances. They further can include the physical discomfort and sense of shame, wrong, and outrage. These are also called compensatory damages as they compensate the injured party for the actual injuries sustained and no more. Very interesting, important to keep track of these things. Punitive damages are those that grow out of the wantonness and atrocity or aggravated by the act. They are the injuries and sufferings that were intended or occurred through malice, carelessness, or negligence, amounting to a wrongful so reckless and wanton as to be without excuse. These are also called exemplary damages. Anyone who assists or participates in an unlawful arrest or imprisonment is equally liable for the damage caused. Thus, where a man was illegally arrested by the police and was placed in a patrol wagon in which he was taken to the central station, it was held that the two officers in charge of the patrol wagon were liable, along with the arresting officer, for false imprisonment. Let me interject here, because we're changing now to false prosecution. Remember, I began reading from this by saying Charles Weissman's telling you how his court trial went. Notwithstanding all this knowledge and all this right for damages, you noticed he didn't get his relief. And I'm bringing that up to show you this is not cut and dried. This is not, you're walking into a system you may not understand that wants to heal itself. It wants to protect itself. It takes a lot more work about getting this. A lot of people will kind of give up at this point. But I'm trying to show us as we're moving into a seemingly more dire times and conditions and controls, typically going to be more administrative, that you are going to necessarily start to have to understand some of this, not to scream it at somebody, but to understand it's in your back pocket, and you're listening not to tell them anything more than to get from them the elements you need on the level of the action you're going to be writing. Your mind is completely focused on other things than trying to explain how many rights you have. It's getting ready, causing them to create the record that allows you to write down and fill in the blanks on what a cause of action for false imprisonment is. And you're going to have to do that correctly and truthfully if you have any chance to get close. So moving on to the article now, instead of false imprisonment, this idea of malicious prosecution, and there's a confusion apparently that Weissman found, quite a big one that you need to pay attention to, and don't fall into the problem and misargue the point. While malicious prosecution, in many cases of imprisonment or wrongful arrest, there has also been a misunderstanding made between the charges of false imprisonment and the malicious prosecution. While both may often involve a restraint of one's liberty, the two charges are not interchangeable or synonymous. There is a fundamental difference between these two charges. They are made up and of different elements, enforced by different forms of action, are governed by different rules of pleading, evidence, and damages, and are subject to different defenses. One description of the malicious prosecution is as follows. Malicious prosecution is an action ex delicto for the recovery of damages which have proximately resulted to person, property, or reputation from a previous unsuccessful civil or criminal proceeding which was prosecuted without probable cause and with malice. In an action of this type, the burden rests upon the plaintiff, the one bringing the suit, to establish each of all of the following propositions before being entitled to recover, to wit. 1. He was prosecuted in a criminal proceeding or civil suit. 2. Defendant instigated such a prosecution. 3. The prosecution terminated favorably to the accused. 4. The defendant acted without probable cause. 5. Defendant acted with malice. And 6. Damages that were caused. In Indiana, a case arose where a man sued several officers for unlawfully arresting and imprisoning him in the county jail and without any charge preferred against him. The defendants insisted his complaint was bad as it did not allege the imprisonment was malicious and without probable cause. The state Supreme Court rejected this claim, stating there is a marked distinction between malicious prosecution and false imprisonment. If the imprisonment is under legal process, but the action has been commenced and carried on maliciously and without probable cause, it is malicious prosecution. If it has been extrajudicial without legal process, it is false imprisonment. An arrest or imprisonment can be malicious or false, but not both. In a case of malicious prosecution, the arrest or detention is procured for malicious motives and without probable cause, but was done under the lawful process, whereas in false imprisonment, the detention is without proper legal authority. Anyone may be legally arrested for some alleged reason, but done maliciously. If he is found to be not guilty, he then has a case for malicious prosecution, but not false imprisonment. If the arrest is not pursuant to legal forms of the law, then whether he is guilty or not, he has a case for false imprisonment, but not malicious prosecution. If this is done with malice, it could add punitive damages to the suit. In describing the distinction between these two charges, the Supreme Court of Oregon stated that the foundation of the cause of action for false imprisonment is the right which even a guilty man has to be protected against any unlawful restraint of his personal liberty, while a malicious prosecution case is founded upon the right of an innocent man to be compensated in damages for any injury he may sustain when a groundless charge is brought against him, even though such charge may be presented and prosecuted in accordance with the strictest forms of law. In other words, the want of authority is an essential element in an action for false imprisonment, whereas malice and want of probable cause are the essentials in an action for malicious prosecution. Somewhat different to the wrong of malicious prosecution is the charge of abuse of process, which is the misuse of legal process for an ulterior purpose, in which malice or ill will may also be a factor. So as I scroll through here to go through, understand the battlefield. Understand that you may be in a different battlefield. Don't do that to yourself. Make sure that when you get the elements together for whatever you want to go on in action, you have gained the elements you need to put in a complaint. And notice what is involved. And again, false imprisonment you don't have to argue malice or anything. It's the fact that there was no legal process, no legal duty that was available. And so keep track of this as we go. Arrest without a warrant, we're going to go foray into that. Because this is what most people are looking at a lot of times, just to touch base on it, the law of the land. The authority to arrest without warrant was rather limited and well-defined at common law. A law which has been made part of our constitutional law is in the due process provision. The common law rule on arrest is based on common sense. As a general rule, at common law, an arrest cannot be made without a warrant. Thus, the right to arrest a person without a warrant is an exception to the general rule. This simple rule was expressed by Justice Carpenter in delivering an opinion from the Supreme Court of Michigan as follows. The law governing this case is elementary, except for a breach of the peace committed in the presence or when he has a reasonable ground to believe that the person arrested is a felon or is about to commit a felony. A police officer has no authority to arrest without a warrant. The objective in this law has to be, going into, that was the statement, now I go into the writing of the document, so you're not confused here. The objective of this law was to have a balance between preserving liberty and preserving the peace. Those who committed the most heinous crimes, that being felonies, were a threat to the safety of society and could be summarily deprived of their liberty by arrest. Those committing a breach of the peace could also be summarily arrested, not for apprehension as a criminal, but to preserve the peace. But for other offenses, summary arrest had to yield to the liberty of the citizen. The liberty of the citizen is too sacred to be left to the arbitrary will of men. Everyone knows what felonies are. The most common felonies are murder, rape, kidnapping, sodomy, abortion, treason, and arson. A breach of the peace is obvious and well known. Therefore, everyone's liberty was safe since all knew for what they could and could not be arrested. But where is the safety in one's liberty if they are subject to every ordinance or law that the legislative body may choose to enact, or if the law on arrest can be changed by statute? By the due process clause, the common law governs what the law on arrest is in this land, and where it exists, the most statutes can be is declaratory of the common law. If there is no direct language in the Constitution directing that procedure or process is to be followed, the common law is the due process of the law followed, not the legislative statute or city ordinance. Officers who do not abide by this law are trespassers and are guilty of false imprisonment. So here's the situation where the common law is supposed to rule, as we understand the common law, where the statute comes violation of that, it can be challenged. Where it doesn't, it has to be followed. What he doesn't say here is that you're going to find what due process is, the duty of the due process owed to people by the officials is written in the legislative code. And this is where you start to go find out, you'll read and you say, well, when you get arrested, especially for these misdemeanors, you're supposed to be brought immediately to a magistrate. I'll tell you what, I've never seen that happen myself. I've never, ever seen that happen. In other words, I started to think back through, that was the point for me, thinking back through, when have I ever seen that? And since I know that that's a provision in the law, you have to go find the provision in your state law that says that you're supposed to be, when you're arrested, you're supposed to be brought for a magistrate for a preliminary hearing on the correctness of the detention charge, which means you have to know the law as you go in, but if they're supposed to bring you there, they're not supposed to bring you to jail. This document's saying when they didn't do that, that's a false imprisonment. And so we have a potential remedy here to start knocking back against this oppression that's coming down. And where do you get that? You don't make that up. You don't say, oh, I think common law meant this. You go to the local statutes, and it says what the office of the executive is supposed to do in the administration of the laws. Any part of which that is violated, that touches on your rights, is a due process breach. This is saying it's also false imprisonment. Breach of the peace and felony arrests. What is a breach of the peace? The answer is a breach of the peace may be generally defined as a violation of the public order, which amounts to a disturbance of the public tranquility or by inciting others to do so. It is clear that not every misdemeanor is a breach of the peace. To constitute a breach of the peace, there must be some violence or harm existing or threatened to occur to a person, property, health, or morals. A phrase, assaults, riotous conduct, and destruction of property make up the largest part of what can be called a breach of the peace. Thus, in the majority of cases, a breach of the peace, some actual violence is present. In some states, there has been attempts to expand the meaning of the breach of the peace, the term breach of the peace, to include all indictable misdemeanors. Quote, but this, it must be confessed, is doing so serious violence to the simple expression, easily and well understood, close quote. To some of these, the types of breaches of the peace, are described as following. A breach of the peace includes acts of public turbulence, acts of violence or tending to produce violence or tending to incite violence, disturbance of the public tranquility by yelling, hollering, uttering loud or vociferous language, making disturbing noises on a public street or by one in a state of intoxication, wanton discharge of firearms in the public place, engaging in a fray or an assault, uttering abusive, profane, indecent, or otherwise provocative language. In discussing what constitutes a breach of the peace, the Supreme Court of North Carolina held A breach of the peace is a public offense done by violence or one causing likely to cause an immediate disturbance of the public order. Breaches of the peace are acts with a malum in se, being wrongful or evil by their nature. Thus, acts which are malum prohibita are those acts made wrong merely by statute, cannot be classed as a breach of the peace. Those acts which constitute a breach of the peace have been settled throughout the course of common law. The legislature cannot declare any act they choose to be a breach of the peace. The nature of the act determines if it fits the common law definition of breach of the peace. The acts that are only malum prohibita include liquor prohibition laws, traffic laws, labor law, health laws, can I say that again? Health laws, food laws, building codes and zoning ordinances, safety acts, game laws, and the very many other police regulations. Without a statute, most of the acts constituting these offenses would be innocent acts. So let me go back up where it talked about the danger to the society. They talk about violence. Well, remember, I told you one state, in this case Oregon, laid out how what the bottom line for a business was in stopping you from going in. And that was if you were constituted a risk of death or injury to their party, to their patrons, or themselves. And so here we have the violence. Why I told you to address it. So, because you're addressing this thing. You're determining they don't have evidence. I got this from the state suggestion, okay? So it's not even my opinion. I just applied it. The bottom line of the whole discussion with a third party is whether, in that case, in the communicable disease, whether or not you have the possibility to, do they have evidence that you have the possibility to commit death, just hurt somebody, violence, if you will. Once you negate that, it can't be considered the breach of the peace that they may be able to arrest you for. That's why when you listen to some of the stories that you heard, the cops would just come in and listen, and they wouldn't do much. The guys probably knew what they were doing a bit. And then it took more, what did it take here? More, I guess the cops could get involved and try to get you to do something, but most of the smart people didn't. You know, they didn't get involved that way. And so you saw the cops back off. And this is the thing, you get to watch very carefully. The videos I would see, the cops would back off the person that was being attacked by the business owner, or even by other customers. They would say, are you witnessing a crime? And they would have to say, no, they're not. And then they would say that they had the right to be in the store like everybody else. And they did their thing that way. And so we have to keep track of how this works. Notice who might know, like the cops might know about it. You're probably not going to get those guys, but you're not wanting to get those guys. You don't want to involve the officials if you don't have to. You don't want to involve the state. And so you're really just focusing now on the people that they took in good faith that you were wrong because you are presumed on a presumptive illness, a threat. And I told you that the law, the states were saying that what you had to do was to eliminate that threat. And though I suggested you did that by having the one who's trying to stop you produce evidence that you are. Now, if you see in the context of this false arrest, you start to see, or false imprisonment, excuse me, you start to see in context why I was suggesting that to be done. Moving on through here, arrests for breach of the peace. In the struggle of government to claim the exercise greater powers of arrest, it is unlawfully attempted to apply the common law rule for a breach of the peace arrest to all misdemeanors. The general rule of the law under the common law for the arrest of misdemeanor offenses amounting to a breach of the peace is stated as follows. In cases of misdemeanor, peace officer, like a private person, has a common law. I'm going to restate that. In cases of misdemeanor, a peace officer, like a private person, has at common law no power of arresting without a warrant except when a breach of the peace has been committed in his presence or there is reasonable ground for supposing that a breach of the peace is about to be committed or renewed in his presence. I want to make sure I read that clearly. That's very important to understand that the peace officer is like a private person here. But you got to make sure you have your facts that you can state that were that are this condition. Reading here. An arrest can only be made to suppress and prevent the breach of the peace, and the act ceases, there is no longer justification for the arrest without warrant. Quote, a constable cannot arrest, but when he sees an actual breach of the peace, and if the affray to be over, he cannot arrest, and where a breach of the peace has been committed and was over, the constable must proceed in the same way as any other person, namely by obtaining a warrant from a magistrate. The rules for arrest without warrant involving misdemeanors was stated in the article in the Michigan Law Review as follows, quote, neither O, a police officer, nor C, a private citizen, may arrest D, a person, for M, a misdemeanor, which is not a BP, a breach of the peace. In regards to this rule, it was stated, neither an officer nor citizen may arrest for a misdemeanor which does not amount to the breach of the peace, even though it occurs in his presence. As for example, talking loudly in the street in the presence of an officer who ordered the parties to be quiet, an arrest without a warrant was not justified, nor where D, in the presence of an O, the officer, was, quote, turning toward the wall for a particular purpose, close quote, of relief in the street, and where he was disturbing a public meeting, or obstructing the free passage across the bridge, or refusing to move on the sidewalk at the request of an officer, or fraudulently substituting a smaller for a larger check, or fraudulently evading payment of a railroad fare, or maintaining a bill for a board on the sidewalk, or insulting the head of the house in the presence of a family, or assembling to witness a Sunday ball game or movie. It is a common rule that an officer cannot arrest for a breach of the peace after it has ended. When a breach of the peace ceases, the reason for the arrest ceases, that being to stop or prevent the breach of the public order. Mr. Bishop, in his treatise on criminal procedure, speaking on the subject of arrest for breaches of the peace, says, after this tumult is over, with no prospect of its renewal, it's too late to interfere without judicial process. And other past misdemeanors are within the same rule, namely that a private person or even an officer cannot, without a warrant, arrest one for a misdemeanor committed on an occasion already past. The principle behind the common law rule of arrest was that in order to prevent harm, violence, or disturbance to the public peace, it is necessary that those perpetrating such acts are promptly stopped by arrest. Where, however, the offense is an accomplished fact, its prevention is no longer possible. Also, in the public order that has been fully restored, before the officer appears, the power to arrest without warrant for a misdemeanor breach of the peace no longer exists, for the end by which such authority to arrest is allowed to maintain the public peace is no longer attainable. To the occasions which would justify arrest without process for vagrancy would indeed be very rare, inasmuch as it involves no immediate danger to the public or private security. Under American common law, no one can be required to, quote, give an account of themselves, close quote, or to show that they have, quote, visible means of support, close quote, or that they have employment. As a part of the right of law to life, all have a right to choose how to live and how to support themselves, and no government act can interfere with this right. The majority of misdemeanor offenses would not fall in the class of a breach of the peace, which allow the immediate intervention of authority by arrest, as they are not an offense of grave nature, or because they do not actually disturb the public peace. An arrest for breach of the peace in the officer's presence must be made, quote, promptly, close quote, either, quote, at the time of the offense, close quote, or, quote, as soon as circumstances permit, close quote. If the officer does not act immediately after the offense has been committed, He can thereafter make arrests only by procuring a warrant. When an officer, after having seen a breach of the peace committed, departs on other business or for other purposes and afterwards returns, he cannot, without warrant, make an arrest for the offense. But where the officer finds it necessary to procure assistance, a reasonable time may be employed in the pursuit. In such a case, the officer must at once set about the arrest and follow up with the effort until the arrest is effected. Kind of like that hot pursuit idea, right? Interjected. Okay, moving back to this. An unreasonable delay will make an arrest invalid. In order to justify a delay, there should be a continued attempt on the part of the officer to make the arrest. This is important when you find out, the practice is that when you get stopped by one of these officials and they go put you somewhere and they leave you to the holding of custody of somebody else, that's a false imprisonment. Because due process is that he's supposed to handle the officers, not he, but the officer is supposed to handle you differently by the black and white, not your opinion, not even by the ancient common law, but what's written today on how that's supposed to go down. Moving down in through here, an excerpt here, threatened a breach of the priest. Peace, I guess it is. An officer cannot arrest because he thinks or has suspicions that a breach of the peace might be committed. The cause for arresting upon such cases must be when a breach of the peace is threatened or its occurrence is imminent. Word imminent, it's in quotes. Again, all these, you see these texts, you got to go find out what that definition, how the courts are treating those terms. Moving into the discussion here in the writing by Charles Weissman, back in 1996 or so, his final thing I have a document for. In determining when officers may interfere by arrest to prevent a threatened breach of the peace, the Supreme Court of Michigan stated, "We are of the opinion that a threat or other indication of a breach of the peace will not justify an officer in making an arrest unless the facts are such as would warrant the officer in believing an arrest is necessary to prevent an immediate execution thereof, or there is a threat or a threat is made coupled with some overt act in attempting execution thereof. The object of permitting an arrest under such circumstances is to prevent a breach of the peace where the facts show danger of its being immediately committed. Thus, the interposition of the officer in the threatened breach of the peace is not for the purpose of the arrest, but, quote, to prevent a disturbance of the breach of the peace under a present menace or violence." So understand what's being stated here. It's nothing to do with just making the arrest. It's to stop that breach of the peace. The peace officer is to keep the peace. Doesn't say he's supposed to make the arrest. So moving here back into more discussion. Again, excerpts. I'm just running through this. Then we're going to go down to, now we have to understand what the other side can do. Once you're going to charge them, you have to understand what their defenses will be. And you have to make sure that they can't use them or take them away or interfere with them. Defenses to unlawful arrests. And remember, here we have the warranted runs and the unwarranted ones. And I don't know if I'm going to get to the statement about it, but you got to be careful if they're without a warrant, then the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply. Because that's only about warranted arrests with warrants. So you got to be careful again. You got to continue to analyze your condition as you're going through. Everyone's going to likely be different. Defenses to unlawful arrests. This section will be a benefit not only to those who may initiate a suit for false imprisonment, but also for peace officers, as it further outlines what is the extent of their authority. Dropping down. Most of the erroneous defenses have been due to misconstruing the requirements of a suit for malicious prosecution with those of requirement for false imprisonment. Again, caveat, don't do this. Don't confuse them. Burden of proof. In false imprisonment suits or in allegations of false arrest, it can be no defense that the one who was arrested must prove that the arrest was unlawful in order to prevail in the suit. Due to the high regard placed on liberty, all imprisonments of a person are deemed unlawful until the contrary is shown. In Halsbury's Law of England, in speaking on suits of false imprisonment, it says, the plaintiff need not prove that the imprisonment was unlawful or malicious, but instead a prima facie case. If he proves that he was imprisoned by the defendant, the onus then lies on the defendant on proving a justification. The only thing the plaintiff needs to plead to prove is one of two things. Either one, that the defendant made an arrest or imprisonment, or two, that the defendant affirmatively instigated, encouraged, incited, or caused the arrest or imprisonment. When the plaintiff has shown that he was arrested, imprisoned, or restrained of his liberty by the defendant, quote, the law presumes it to be unlawful. I need to interject this. Remember now, go back to what I was saying. You asked the business owner, in this case, if you're trying to be blocked out of a business, and I'm just saying this communicable disease law because everybody was going through it and complaining. No one did a lawsuit or anything like this, but you, when I told you to, you assert the requirement to show the evidence that you are at risk of death or communicable harm, an official evidence of that, that this is what you're doing. You're taking away the ability for them to have a defense. Unless they can show that official order that you were the communicable principal and you needed to be confined. So moving back into the discussion here by Charles Weissman, thus it had to be held that in false imprisonment suits, the defendant, in order to escape liability, must either prove that he did not imprison the plaintiff or he must justify the imprisonment. Stated another way, the burden is upon the defendant to show the arrest was by authority of law. And this interjection, this is what I tell you about burden flipping. These are the kinds of things I look for. This was a beautiful one. All you have to do is assert the probably about four things you assert. I've read the two last. I can't remember the first two. You just assert those on a document for false action of false imprisonment. The burden flips immediately. They have to show justification. If within your facts you show they could not have any justification, that's what we would say it would be go for summary judgment. Now, that's just on the surface. It's not without the interjections of the judges and attorneys or those bar members. But moving back to the article, in a case where the two police officers arrested a man who they believed committed a felony, the jury was instructed that the burden of proof by a fair preponderance of the evidence was upon the plaintiff to show the arrest and imprisonment were not justified. The instruction was held to be wrong on appeal, where the court stated, it was long ago said by Lord Mansfield, a gaoler is, if he has a, would be a jailer, I think here, if he has a prisoner in custody, is prima facie guilty of imprisonment and therefore must justify. In Batkin versus Powell, it was said by Chief Justice Best, quote, where a man deprives another of his liberty, the injured party, is entitled to maintain an action for false imprisonment, and it is for the defendant to justify his proceeding by showing that he had legal authority for doing what he had done. Where the arrest was done without a warrant, the person arresting would have to justify by showing that he acted pursuant to due process of law by showing that there was a felony and breach of the peace committed. Where an officer arrests a person without a warrant, the burden rests upon the officer to plead and prove justification. Otherwise, the arrest is prima facie unlawful. We go back to the previous paragraph. Extend that to those businesses, as I was telling you. There's no due process that was followed by the health official. The business can't have any to rely on. Now I'm hoping you see right there how the domino effect of justification is taken away all the way down the line. It's a fraud from the beginning to the end. But rereading here, in a case in Iowa, the mayor of the town had instructed the town marshal to arrest a man because he had been reported. It had been reported that he was drunk and had been disturbing the peace. The marshal arrested the man in his home without a warrant. When the man sued the mayor and the marshal for false imprisonment, the court instructed the jury that the burden of proof was upon the plaintiff, the man arrested, to prove that he was not found intoxicated when arrested. On appeal, the Supreme Court of Iowa held that the court, quote, announced an incorrect rule of evidence on the matter. The Supreme Court, in defining the correct rule, stated in Bishop on criminal procedure, it is said, quote, in matters of evidence, if the imprisonment is proved, its unlawfulness will be prima facie presumed, but authority may be shown by the defendant in justification. If the marshal had a valid warrant, this would serve as justification for the arrest and as a defense to the charge of a false imprisonment. But he had none, and he witnessed no breach of the peace. He had no defense against the charge. The rule of the burden of proof is the same in the criminal proceeding where, quote, an arrest made without a warrant if challenged by the defendant is presumptively invalid, and the burden is upon the state to justify it as one not only authorized by statute, but also as one not violative of constitutional provisions. The invalidity of the arrest will render the search invalid and the evidence obtained inadmissible. This was so held in a court case, Testolin versus State in 1925. So good faith and probable cause. Going through this thing here quick. The most common defense raised in a false imprisonment suit is that the arresting officer acting in good faith and with good intent. This argument of defense is often raised along with the defense that the officer had probable cause. Both of these defenses are often misapplied to the action of false arrest. Such defenses are more applicable to suits involving malicious prosecution or abuse of process rather than false imprisonment, as stated by the Supreme Court of Iowa. False imprisonment is the unlawful restraint of an individual's personal liberty or freedom of locomotion. The good faith of the actor is no justification, nor is it the want of probable cause an essential element, as in the case of malicious prosecution. In the case of false imprisonment, the only essential elements of the action are detention and its unlawfulness. Thus, malice and want of probable cause need not be shown, or are not necessary to a proper cause of action for false arrest. Even where the unlawful arrest is claimed to have been for the public good, such a defense will not stop damages. It is well settled that the want of reasonable or probable cause and the want of malice or elements not entering into the action of false imprisonment is so far as actual damages are concerned. The question of probable cause in its usual sense is not involved in the action of false imprisonment. Thus, according to the great weight of authority, the existence of probable cause is not an element or nor a defense to an action for false imprisonment. A case in South Dakota developed where a sheriff had, due to the mistaken identity, arrested the wrong person as an embezzler on a warrant which did not name or describe the person to be arrested. The sheriff alleged good faith and probable cause for arresting the man. The state Supreme Court held that the fact that the sheriff acted in good faith and with probable cause was no defense and may not be taken into account in determining the damages which will compensate the plaintiff. In many cases, officers will try to justify an arrest for a misdemeanor based upon a strong belief that the person arrested is guilty. In such a case, the appellate court of Illinois held in an action of trespass and false imprisonment, probable cause and the absence of malice constitute no defense. In this form of action, belief in the guilt of a party arrested, no matter how strong or well-founded in the mind of the officer or person making the arrest, will not justify the deprivation of another of his liberty, and it is unimportant whether the circumstances would lead a reasonable or prudent person to believe that the accused was actually guilty. In some cases, instead of asserting that the officer acted in good faith, the defense is raised that malice must be proven on the part of the arresting officer. This defense is, however, groundless in matters of false imprisonment. In an action for false imprisonment, neither actual malice nor want of probable cause is an essential element necessary to recover for general damages. Whatever the motives of the arresting officer, they are not cause or bring about a change in the legality of an arrest, as was asserted by the Supreme Court of Missouri. A lawful imprisonment does not become unlawful because of malicious motives, nor does it unlawful and unlawful detention become lawful because actuated by a laudable purpose or founded in good faith. Closely related to the defense of good faith and lack of malice is that an arrest is justified where there is no force or injury done to the person arrested, but the United States Court of Appeals stated, this does not justify an arrest. All that is necessary to establish false imprisonment is that an individual be restrained of his liberty under the probable imminence of force without any legal cause or justification, therefore. It is not necessary to show actual force, threats, or injury done to the individual person, character, or reputation. The lack of malice, the presence of a good faith, the presence of probable cause, do not affect the existence of the wrong when the detention is unlawful. Where a deputy game warden had arrested a man without a warrant and incarcerated him in the county jail, the deputy claimed that at the time of the arrest, he had probable cause for believing the plaintiff was then violating the law by hunting without a license. It was held that there was a false imprisonment involved, as the Supreme Court of Alabama said. In the false imprisonment, the essence of the tort is that the plaintiff is forcibly deprived of his liberty and that the good intent of the defendant, or the fact that he had the probable cause for believing that the offense was committed and acted in good faith, will not justify and excuse the trespass. In an action against the mayor and police court judge for alleged false arrest and imprisonment, it was claimed that the defendants acted maliciously with a design to injure the plaintiff. It was held by the Supreme Court of Kansas that based upon the claim of malice, the defendants were not liable for the false arrest. The proper remedy would be an action for malicious prosecution. The court also stated the motive with which a restraint of liberty is accomplished, be it evil or good, is irrelevant to the question of whether or not an unlawful arrest has been established. The existence of actual malice is a consequence only as it may afford the basis for punitive damages. The court said, as will be seen, malice and willfulness are not essential elements of false imprisonment, and motives of the defendant, whatever they may have been, are not material to the case. And the Court of Appeals in Maryland has stated, in a false imprisonment suit, the essence of the tort consists in depriving the plaintiff of his liberty without lawful justification, and the good or evil intention of the defendant does not excuse or create the tort. Any deprivation by the one person of the liberty of another without his consent constitutes an imprisonment, and if this is done unlawfully, it is false imprisonment without regard to whether it is done with or without probable cause. In a case of false imprisonment, the defendant claimed that the petition did not state a cause of action for the reason that it was not alleged that the imprisonment was malicious and without a probable cause. The trial court held that these claims were only valid in suits of malicious prosecution and that there was a marked distinction between malicious prosecution and false imprisonment. The Kentucky Court of Appeals affirmed this position with various cites. In Starkey Evid, it said, no proof of malice or want of probable cause is necessary to make a case for false imprisonment. Where the life, liberty, and property of the citizen are at stake, good intentions are never good enough. It has been stated that the citizen's liberty must not depend upon good faith merely, but upon legal rules governing official action. Interjection. Due process. What's black and white? What's written? Why I keep suggesting you need to go find what that is. Don't make it all up. Just assert it. Just find it and see what it is. And then place your facts on that. But moving in back to this reading, it has been held many times that in cases of false imprisonment, quote, the defendant can only avoid liability for false arrest by pleading justification for the arrest. All other arguments must necessarily fail. Close quote. Ignorance of the law. Again, defenses, remember? It is a fundamental maxim of the law that ignorance of the law is no excuse in violating it. One such maxim is as follows. Ignorance of the fact excuses. Ignorance of the law excuses not. Every man must be cognizant of the law. Otherwise, there is no saying to what extent the excuse of ignorance may not be carried. It has been said that an unlawful detention or imprisonment does not become lawful because done out of ignorance of the law. The Georgia Court of Appeals has held that, quote, it is no defense that a person perpetrating an illegal arrest or imprisonment is ignorant of the illegality of his acts. Knowingly committing an arrest which is illegal is sufficient to fix liability. False imprisonment is treated as a tort and also a crime if the conduct is unlawful. Neither good faith nor provocation nor ignorance of the law is a defense to the person committing the wrong. And we move on to, I think there's a jump in my article, it goes into a discussion, it moves out into a different story, and it says, based on a woman failing to plead or prove that the proceedings leading to arrest or imprisonment in the asylum were terminated, had terminated, in the, another story, again, there's a page missing, but it's important to show consistently the woman was not under any obligation here, the court saying, the weight of authority is against the proposition that in a suit for false imprisonment, the prosecution should terminate before a suit for damages can be instituted. Let me interject here quickly. This is the fundamental rights power. You don't have to go through a bunch of administrative or judicial nonsense to get to your remedy, or at least not necessarily so in most instances where there's real more better justice being implemented. Going on to read here, before the damages are instituted in a suit for false imprisonment, a record of conviction for the same offense for which the arrest was made is inadmissible. Can I read that again? In a suit for false imprisonment, a record of conviction for the same offense for which the arrest was made is inadmissible. An action for false imprisonment is based upon the legality of the arrest, not upon the filing of a complaint or the proof of an alleged crime or the results of the trial. As the California Supreme Court said, the finding of guilt in the subsequent criminal proceeding cannot legalize an arrest unlawful when made. Even where a party has pleaded guilty, the one making the arrest can still be liable for an illegal arrest. Thus, it may be held that a consent to an unlawful arrest will not excuse an officer or person from their acts, as held by the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals. We are of the opinion that the law does not permit a citizen to consent to unlawful restraint, nor permit such a claim to be made upon the part of the defendants. In Wharton and Criminal Law, Volume 1, Section 75, it is said, no man has a right to take away another's liberty, even though with the consent, except by process of law. The reason is that the liberty is an unalienable prerogative of which no man can divest himself, and of which any divestiture is null. Very powerful statement. You can't even divest your own unalienable. They cannot be taken from you at all, and they're inside you, then they can never depart from you. Immunity. The argument of official immunity as a defense here would seem to be obvious and logical argument for an officer in defense of a charge of false imprisonment. Government is generally immune from being sued, and peace officers are regarded as members of the government. Thus, it is often claimed that they are immune from suit. But the immunity doctrine does not extend to anyone in government who causes a wrong. But immunity from suit is a high attribute of sovereignty, a prerogative of the state itself, which cannot be availed of by public agents when sued for their own torts. Under the doctrine of official immunity, there has been a distinction made between acts that are discretionary duties, which are an officer in performance of which the officer is immune, and the acts which are ministerial duties for which officers remain liable. An officer's official duty is described as ministerial, quote, when it is absolute, certain, and imperative, involving merely execution of a specific duty arising from fixed and designated facts, close quote. My interjection to the legal health officer, or any time you have a black and white due process that's required that's breached, that's the duty that's not cannot be claimed an immunity for. An arrest by an officer is a ministerial, not discretionary act. Very important to keep these facts together so that you don't lose the point on how this rolls out for you, and so you don't get confused, and the judge can't be confused. Inaccuracies or imperfections do not vitiate a warrant which substantially charges an offense, but where a complaint recited in substance in a warrant is verified merely on information and belief and does not state facts sufficient to constitute an offense, the warrant must be held to be invalid on its face. And so this is your analysis when you're having stuff happen to you. When you define and demand the warrant and they hand it to you, or reasonably soon so, you're looking for these compliances. You have to have those in your mind, how that works, real time. Also, going on reading here, an affidavit that is merely states the belief in the guilt of the accused is insufficient to support a warrant of arrest. The Supreme Court of Kansas said that a warrant cannot be issued which is verified on the county attorney's hearsay and belief. How many times have I seen this one, folks? Anyway, moving on here. If a warrant in the first instance may issue upon mere hearsay or belief, then all the guards of common law and the Bill of Rights to protect the liberty and property of the citizens against arbitrary power are swept away. An affidavit based on the presumption or belief of a crime does not give jurisdiction to the court to issue a warrant. And at common law, a constable or sheriff cannot execute a warrant outside of their jurisdiction. To summarize, the following are the basic requisites needed to make a warrant valid. A warrant is to be issued by a judicial officer and signed by him. It must state the facts that show the matter to be within the jurisdiction of the judicial officer issuing it. It cannot be based upon belief or suspicion, but upon probable cause. The warrant is to list a complaint which is to state the offense committed and the facts that constitute the crime. Those are those elements. You've got to make sure what those are. Going on here, two more here. A warrant is to contain an affidavit of the person making the charge under oath. And it must truly name the person to be arrested and describe him sufficiently to identify him. The officer is bound to know if, under the law, the warrant is defective and not fair on its face, and he is liable as a trespasser if it does not appear on its face to be a lawful warrant. His ignorance is no excuse. Every citizen, when arrested, should, when arrested, at or trial, request to see the warrant and check that it meets the required criteria and object if it does not. Such vigilance is necessary to secure the liberty of the stop the unlawful oppressive measures from continuing in government. This is what my whole point about my interjection with the health communicable health disease laws are. And so, as fast as I'm reading, it doesn't look like I made it to the end. Maybe we'll make this a different reading and a different thing. I will not be getting onto the extension, apparently, onto who these people are that are making these decisions and making these laws, so-called common law. And what I'm leaving us off on is the fact of the duty of an officer. Again, we always go to the duties. Charles Wiseman will explain more. We're almost there, but not quite. Honestly, even as fast as I was reading, quite a bit of information, like I said. You have to do quite a bit of study and to get these together. But this false imprisonment kind of looks pretty interesting to me and relative really closely to what the communicable disease law failures were. And if we get our minds wrapped, as I told you, get your minds wrapped around this really bright line of where the failures are, how to identify it, you're going to be able to expand much quicker on understanding what else is available to us. So I think we're going to adjourn here and hope something I said gives you some inspiration to go looking, find the documents. I don't know how to get these to you, but we'll get them to you at some point. But I hope something I've said encourages you to keep yourself vigilant and be persistent to protect yourself against this criminality that seems to be normalized against us under the color of police power that is subject to the due process and other limitations. I'll be with you next week. Tech Diffs or Nature Will.
Another lesson. I hope with today's information you can take it to those that misbehave. From behind the woodshed, leaving his mark on the beast, this is Hal Anthony. Till next time, journey with purpose.
Up a can of whoop-ass feels like.
Son,
just opened a whole case of Wolfpath.